You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
I'm joined in the park just outside THE's London headquarters by Jim Bock, Swarthmore College's Dean of Admissions since 2001. For those who don't know, Swarthmore is a private liberal arts college located in Pennsylvania. It was established in 1864 and counts philosopher David K. Lewis and former presidential candidate Michael Dukakis among its alumni. Jim, thanks for joining me. Perhaps you could start by telling me a little bit more about your responsibilities at Swarthmore, your day-to-day life.
Yes, thank you, Chris. At Swarthmore College, I'm in charge of recruiting the students from around the United States and the world. Our goal is to search for good candidates who are interested in a liberal arts education, who are open to trying different, interested in social sciences, humanities, natural sciences, and really about choice. They may have an interest in what they want to study, but we're also open to students who aren't quite sure what they want to pursue after 4 years. And our goal is to visit high schools, public high schools, private high schools, both domestically and internationally, and help them learn more about Swarthmore in particular, but the liberal arts as well in general.
Mm-hmm. And we're sitting in London, so presumably that means you're here targeting UK students in the hope of recruiting them into what would be undergraduate degrees. It's an undergraduate only university.
Absolutely. In fact, we're visiting high schools, private high schools, and also attending the Fulbright Fair, which is this Friday and Saturday. And it's a fair for UK students as well as expatriates who want to pursue an education in the United States. So there'll be several hundred universities as well as colleges here for the next 2 days. It's sharing information about each of our institutions.
Mm. Of course, recently, you'll be aware, fees for domestic students attending UK universities have gone up, tripled in the last few years from 3,000 to 9,000 a year. Have you found that change here has had a knock-on effect in terms of the number of applications you get from UK students wanting to attend Swarthmore? Do you think that HE sector in general in the US is seeing an increase in the number of students abandoning, if you like, the UK HE sector because the US one now seems much more comparable in terms of cost?
They're not abandoning just yet, but they're starting to look more. And so we're seeing more and more students attend this fair and will look to the United States as a possible option. Students are beginning to realize that a lot of U.S. institutions will offer merit scholarships based on qualifications of grades, scores, what they achieved while in high school. But there's also a subset of institutions, many of them who give need-based aid. They will admit a student based on the qualifications, but then offer institutional aid based on the need of the family. And so as those costs have started to increase here, students will look abroad to the U.S., both for the quality of the education, but also for the affordability. And there are still wonderful options here. You're close to home, an excellent education. But we also have, we know that in the UK, it attracts students from all over the world to come for your education for high school. And many stay here, but they will look abroad to the US, Canada, Australia, and all over. And so we've started to see a slight uptick. They will look to apply. If admitted, they still have a tough choice. And there are costs associated with coming across to the US, but we are seeing an increased demand.
Sure. And then those costs, I mean, you presumably have very generous grants for domestic students to make sure less advantaged students can attend. Does that extend to UK students who perhaps want to take the leap and study the other side of the pond, as it were?
Yes, Swarthmore designates a significant portion of its financial aid budget for international students. So again, we don't offer merit scholarships, but our conferences fees are about $60,000, but the average aided international student receives a little over $40,000. Mm-hmm. So when you put in the discount, it's about $15,000 US per year, which sounds more reasonable.
Still pretty steep,
absolutely, we think worth it. And that is the average. So some students will qualify for the whole tuition, room and board. Some will qualify for a portion of that. So when we look to admit students, we admit them based on their grades, their scores, their essays, their recommendations. But then we take a second look at the need of the family. And so a good portion, a little over 10% of our aid budget, is designated for international students from the UK and from countries all over the world.
Sure. We are sat in the park here. I noticed that the rubbish collectors have just chosen to come along. Apologies for the noise. But you mentioned that you're a liberal arts college. It's a fairly broad term. I mean, generally refers to disciplines that don't relate to sort of vocational, technical, professional education. It's been a tough decade, I guess, from a global economic perspective.
Yes.
You've got Obama's new scorecards, which promise to sort of rank universities based on their employment figures. Surely people would be better off these days shunning the liberal arts education and focusing on something a little bit more practical.
No, it's a great question, and one I receive every day. We actually believe that the liberal arts education has never been more important. We think that we give you the skills to think critically, to write analytically, and to communicate effectively. And if you can do those three things, you can do anything. I challenge anyone to tell me what the jobs are going to be in the next 5, 10, 15 years. We know that in the natural sciences, the science they're learning today will be obsolete in 4 or 5 years. And so what you need are the skills to answer the questions for tomorrow. You need to collaborate. You need to think critically. When you ask top businesses, business leaders, what skills they look for, they want writers, they want collaborators, they want creative thinkers. And there are a lot of really bright students who can memorize really well, but they can't then create or generate new knowledge. And that's our whole goal in the liberal arts, is to give a skill set. So they may immediately not have the direct skill set, but they know how to think, how to write, how to communicate, and often the first jobs will give them the training that they need. And if that job you pursue that is vocationally tracked ends, where do you go? You need the skills to be sort of be broad-based. And I think folks think that the liberal arts are liberal and have to do with only the arts, but in fact it's the natural sciences, it's the social sciences, it's the humanities. So it includes not just English for humanities, but philosophy, religion, art history, social sciences, not just history, but political science, sociology, anthropology, politics, economics. About a fifth of our graduates will go straight into business, even though we have no business courses. That's worth more, because they can be trained by the companies who hire them to be the managers and to sell the widgets or the product or whatever. And as that shifts, you need to be able to shift with the times. And that's true in the sciences, the natural sciences, and the humanities.
Yeah. It's sort of fine to say that, isn't it, as an admissions dean at Swarthmore? Mm-hmm. I mean, one of the sort of most respected and well-known institutions. Maybe businesses will be keen to take your graduates on, even though they're not the finished package, as it were, offer them on the job training. What about liberal arts more generally? Do you hear colleagues from institutions perhaps that don't have the ability to be as highly selective as you are?
No, it's an excellent question.
Struggling more.
Right, no, and there are challenges with the economy in terms of certain job skills, but again, we still think, regardless of the rigor or the prestige of the institution, that those skills will carry you beyond. And in fact, internationally, we are starting to see an increase in interest of the liberal arts. And there is NYU Abu Dhabi, there's Yale National University of Singapore, there's a Chesse in Ghana, which are liberal arts colleges abroad, bringing that model abroad, because again, they're having very bright students. And again, technology is great, the engineering, it is one way. It may or may not be the best way, but there are alternatives. And so there's often a concern that the liberal arts, if not at a prestigious place, you may have fewer options. And again, we think it's lifelong learning over time. So is there some risk in that? But there's risk, again, focusing on one industry, and then if that changes. Actually, before my time at Swarthmore, I worked at a business school in the U.S., and you know, about a quarter of the students were ex-military who had great leadership skills but needed the business knowledge. About over half were liberal arts graduates who majored in a lot of different areas and had worked but needed the management skills. And another quarter were former business students who had the bachelor in business administration but wanted the broader view to run the companies. And so again, over half came from liberal arts colleges. So we are not against or a vocation, so to speak, but we feel that this is your one chance. We also believe that a lot of 17-year-olds don't know what they want to be when they grow up. And so choice is a good option for those first 2 years. Even at a liberal arts college, we do require majors, that you major your second or your third year. So you can major in political science or history or biology or chemistry, which is, you know, directed towards a discipline, which then we think those skills will serve you well post-graduation.
It's interesting, isn't it, though? You say that the model is being exported by U.S. institutions overseas. And that's presumably because it's not really a model that we do see overseas. It's a particular sort of U.S. model of education. I mean, if it's so successful, as you say, why hasn't it become more widespread? I mean, take the U.K., typical undergraduate would be 18, similar to your 17-year-old there. They're going straight into a specialised course. Is that an error? Do we need to get more liberal arts going on in the U.K.? And why hasn't that happened already?
No, it's an excellent question. Part of it is time and cost. So our degree, typical degree, is 4 years. Yours is three. Yours is also, right now, less expensive, but we think the value added is what makes the most sense, and also the access to teaching. So often I get the question about research versus teaching and what do you offer. At a residential liberal arts college, all the research is done by the undergraduates because there are no grad students on campus. There are no master's, no PhD program. So there's the perception that if I go to a small school, it's going to be all about the teaching. And in fact, it is, but it's teaching and research. So our faculty are required to teach, do research and actually provide service back to the community. And so it's that collaboration, it's the one-on-one, where most classes have fewer than 25 students. Every lab course has a science component to it. Mm-hmm. And we think that experience and collaboration with faculty doing their research and in teaching suits them well longer. Why hasn't that caught on? Again, because traditionally things have been more vocationally tracked, which again is not a good or a bad model, just a different one. And it's also potentially easier to quantify. What did you receive on this test? Did you memorize the material? And it's more of a linear model, or more formulaic, if you will, in terms of admission. In the U.S., we tend to look more holistically when making decisions. So we will look at your grades, your marks, as well as your standardized tests, but we also require essays. We require written recommendations from two or three faculty members who have taught you in the classroom, and what will you be like in the classroom. And so some in the U.S. tend to be formulaic, others are more holistic in the review. We tend to be more holistic because we also want community members, which is a little bit different. So we look at things like athletic talent, the ability to write for the newspaper, your quality on the debate team, how much service that you do. So it's not one is more important than the other, but what do you offer our community by being offered a spot, but then also what can we do for you in terms of the educational benefits that we provide?
Yeah, and I suppose some of the more highly selected universities in the UK would like to say that they look at a lot of those things as well. I mean, and again, it's because you're presumably you're fairly oversubscribed, I'd imagine, as an institution.
Yes.
Do you know how many places, how many applicants you get?
Yeah, so typically we get around 5,500 or 5,500 applications for about 400 spots, 410 spots. So we this year we admitted about 17% of those applicants. We needed to admit close to 950 to yield a class of 407. Because again, we're competing, if you will, with other schools. So some students might want an Ivy League institution, a state institution. They may be comparing merit awards or need-based awards. So when a student applies, I don't know whether he or she, where they've applied, what they can afford, and really, truly where they want to go. And so we admit more students than we have room for, though we know what our typical yield will be on those offers. And so it remains selective. So that goes to the holistic review. It's not, we don't want students who just want to apply to us because it's a prestigious institution, but why do they want to Swarthmore? Perhaps it's because we're a liberal arts college that has engineering. It's unusual to find engineering as we have a Bachelor of Science degree in engineering. We have the external examination program, which is actually modeled on the Oxford program of tutorials, and we've shaped that into seminars where we invite outside examiners to give them the exams as seniors in four different areas. And we've been doing that since the 1920s, and we think that's true learning, is that you're taught by the faculty member, but you're not examined until senior year by someone who's never met you and never taught you. And that's rigorous academics. So we've actually pulled from the English model of that tutorial system, and so we find great value in that as well.
Sure, sure. Let's take a close look at some of the fees that Swarthmore student might be expected to pay. So tuition, the sticker price, if you like, is $45,000 thereabouts. That's £27,500. $7,000 room, $7,000 board. And then there's a $360 student activities fee, which
yes.
I imagine refers to being, you know, using the sporting facilities, things like that.
Well, actually, that fund goes to the student budget committee, and that's okay. What funds all the clubs and activities.
Yeah.
And then students dole out that money for the different activities on campus.
But in short, when you get to the end of that list, you're looking at, you know, the best part of $60,000 a year. I mean, there's a big push at the moment from Obama in the White House, a couple of big high-profile meetings about this, on access, making sure students from disadvantaged backgrounds are able to go to college. How do you make sure? I mean, I know you'll have lots of grants for people who do apply, but how do you make sure that students from tougher backgrounds don't take one look at that figure, that $60,000 figure, and decide not to apply in the first place? So never mind if you could offer them a grant. They don't even apply because they look and they say, well, it's not for me. I can't afford that.
Right, and that is a challenge. In fact, my own background, I am a Swarthmore graduate. I grew up in Austin, Texas, and I took Swarthmore off the list because it was too expensive. I didn't think I could get in. I ended up applying, and it ended up being the most affordable option for me, even though it was 1,600 miles away from my home. It was less expensive than the local state school based on the need of my family. And so there was a little bit of risk involved in terms of taking that risk even to make the application.
What changed your mind, Adam?
You know what? It was the educational, actually it was a newspaper article. One of our graduates, James Michener, an author, had retired in Austin, and he made the front page of the Austin American Statesman and I think the New York Times in the mid-80s because he had given a gift of, I think, roughly $2 million to Swarthmore. He said, I'm paying back my loans with interest. And when he passed away, he left like his manuscripts to UT and his grad school, but he left some of the rights to his works to Swarthmore College. And so this was someone who had given back. And so I looked beyond just the sticker price and said, here's someone who didn't have the funds to attend, who became an amazing author. And I said, well, let me give it a shot. I won't know if I don't apply, but that does remain one of the challenges. How do we, you know, spread the good word, which is probably why I do what I do today, is to travel, to share information about liberal arts college generally, Swarthmore specifically. And so we partner with community-based organizations, both domestically and abroad. In the UK, we're working with the Sutton Trust, which is trying to reach low-income students to help them understand that these schools not only want them, but we have the funds to help get them there, to not only attend, but to retain them and to graduate them after 4 years. In the U.S., there are a lot of community-based organizations that work with low-income students, so we will visit their after-school programs. We will have on-campus programs for counselors who will come and visit our campus. Just last week, we flew in 140 students from all over the United States who are low-income and underrepresented, who may have never been on a plane, who have not visited a campus, who don't understand what the liberal arts is all about, so that they could sit in on classes and understand what our education is about. And I'll tie something into, you'd asked about financial aid. It actually costs about $85,000 a year to educate each student. There were only, quote, charging 60, which is substantial, I understand that. But then the average aid award for international students is about $43,000. Mm-hmm. And so it's important to us that we use some of our endowment funds to cover costs, not just for domestic students, but international students as well. But I agree, that remains a challenge, getting the word out that these schools are accessible and affordable, though they remain selective. Mm-hmm. And we think that those students should have a range of types of institutions. They should look at state, they should look at private, they should look at schools that offer merit aid as well as need-based aid, because it does remain selective in terms of admission.
Interesting stuff. And finally, I know you mentioned one of the sort of biggest tools, I guess, you have in your armory when it comes to speaking to students is the teaching experience. The liberal arts is well known for being very teaching focused. I don't think I'm out of line in saying that sometimes in UK universities, teaching is pushed, you know, rather to one side, mm-hmm. certainly at the expense of research, which is where the prestige is and often where right. the money is in terms of universities bringing cash in. As fees go up in the UK, do you think that there's a lot for the UK higher education sector to learn from institutions such as Swarthmore, liberal arts institutions, in terms of the value they place on the teaching experience, access to faculty, student service?
Yeah, absolutely. And we value lecture. We value knowledge that the PhD brings to the table. We also look for faculty who not only want to do research and publish, but also teach and work with undergraduates. We find the one-on-one experience or small classroom experience really to be second to none. And in fact, when you think about it, when students go into graduate school or even in your own system, it's tutorial, right? It's one-on-one mentoring in addition to the lecturing or the small seminar format. So we find great value in the seminar and keeping classes small so that the access is there. So it's not that we're taking anything away from the research, but it's sort of hand in hand. We value teaching as well as valuing research. And some have pushed the research because, as you said, it brings in the money, which often institutions have to rely on those private donations and funding because government funds often don't keep pace because just the proposition of education is expensive. I don't know if this is a good analogy, but someone, you know, once mentioned the concept of movie tickets versus theater, live theater. So why does it cost, you know, £100 to go see a show here, but a movie, and again, I don't know what the current cost, but in the U.S., a movie would be $12 and a Broadway ticket would be $120. Right. Well, you're paying equity actors who are quality actors, who are experts in their profession. They're doing it new every night. It's not just put away and you could just go see the movie like a canned lecture.
Or a MOOC.
Or a MOOC, exactly. And we see value in that too, so there is education online. But our model focuses on that interaction and community relationships as well. It's about the learning in the classroom as well as outside. Again, not just in the labs, but in terms of the athletic fields, the debate room, different types of cultural activities on campus to learn from one another. Right now, we tend to be talking past one another, and so we're looking for bridge builders, those who can learn from one another and try to solve some of our problems that we're facing.
A lot easier to do with only 1,500 students on campus, of course.
We think so.
Jim Bock, Swarthmore College Dean of Admissions, thank you very much for talking to me today.
Thank you so much.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.